QR and AI as it was then, King's Regulations and Admiralty Instructions for the RCN, you were entitled to do as an individual. You could make a complaint or state a grievance as an individual person about an individual who is a superior or about a condition of service or whatever. And the rules for doing that were fairly clearly and carefully laid out in those regulations based on the RN rules.
You mentioned that they wanted to get rid of the first lieutenant. Was this just a general grievance, or was that something they specifically thought?
Unfortunately, the first lieutenant had little destroyer experience. Being a wartime RCMVR officer, he tried his best to meet the captain's demands and requirements. The captain, having been just a pre-war officer and had gone the full route with the RN as a midshipman and so on, and had gone, in fact, from the sub-lieutenant of Restigouche to the captain of Restigouche in something like 2.5 years' time. And so he was a very experienced destroyer captain. And this made it terribly tough. And more than that, he knew the pre-war Navy and the pre-war routines, and he was Royal Navy trained. So the fall into the RN routines was very easy for him, which is quite foreign to the first lieutenant, who is wartime RCMVR, small ship, i.e. corvette, frigate, navy. It's very, very different. So basically, although the first lieutenant was the most pleasant individual and in no way unpleasant, and nor were the men implying that he was, but the fact was that he was relatively unable to meet the captain's standards and demands. The result is that the poor man was just running around the ship ragged, and running the rest of the ship ragged, trying to achieve what he felt to meet the captain's requirements.
How about the men? Had most of them seen wartime service?
Yes, yeah. Most of them were wartime service, and some of them were pretty tough individuals who were not adapting that well to the peacetime Navy.
Yeah. Okay, so with the everyone getting discouraged and going away,
that was the end of it. And we knew that, of course, there'd be some kind of investigations later on. But a week later, we sailed back to Hong Kong, having been relieved by HMS Consort. We arrived down in Hong Kong and started a sort of rest and recreation period. And we're having an enjoyable time when the next ship got ready to go up to relieve HMS Consort, and this ship is HMS Amethyst. The Amethyst was a Royal Navy sloop, which is fairly similar to a frigate, but with somewhat more guns. And Amethyst was due, and we were told to escort Amethyst up to the mouth of the Yangtze and do a sort of couple of days workup with her. I can remember being on the bridge as the assistant navigator, and coming out of Hong Kong Harbor with Amethyst, and it was a bright, sunny day. And the captain turned to me and said, "Pilot, make a message to Commodore Hong Kong that we are returning to harbor for 24 hours. The visibility is too low to permit any exercises." I looked around, and the visibility was about 15 miles. I said, "But sir, it's bright daylight and sunshine." He said, "Don't argue, send the message." So I drafted up the message and we sent it. What had happened was the captain of Amethyst's wife had just arrived via an RN troop ship that very night. And he had had to sail before they had been able to make contact. And when our captain found out about this, he made this fake message and brought Amethyst back into the harbor, we being the senior ship of the two. And the captain of Amethyst met and saw his wife for the first time in about 2 years, and was able to spend one evening with her before he left. Now, if you remember the story of the Amethyst went up the Yangtze, and the Nationalists, who by this time had deserted to the communist side, opened fire on her from the South Bank, and with American anti-tank guns, and hit the bridge, mortally wounded the captain, killed several men, including the coxswain, and the steering jammed, and Amethyst went hard onto the bank, where she subsequently stayed for several months. HMS Consort, having heard that Amethyst was in trouble, immediately set sail from Nanking and came steaming down the Yangtze to the rescue of Consort, to herself get engaged in a hail of fire, again with anti-tank shells, which through a destroyer's thin plating go literally in one side through machinery, equipment, and men, and out the other. Consort started to take a pretty bad battering, and Amethyst told Consort to leave the area and get out of it while she still could, which Consort very wisely chose to do. We were then ordered up to the mouth of the Yangtze to escort her back down, because her radars had been shot away and so on, and the visibility was fairly low. We steamed north at high speed, and I can remember coming out of the fog into fairly bright sunshine to see HMS Consort coming down the coast, down by the bow, steering from aft, from the after conning position, huge white ensign, battle ensign flying, and coming lickety-split down at about 28 knots. So much so we had to turn around and go up to full speed just to keep up with her. And she came into Hong Kong Harbor at that kind of speed, being steered from aft, from the after conning position. A very sort of proud show basically what was a defeat to the RN. And but I must admit, it's quite an inspiring sight to see her down by the head as she was, and still steaming along at that kind of speed. A little bit foolhardy, perhaps, but nevertheless, that kind of bravado was thought to be necessary. The aftermath of the Amethyst thing, of course, was that the captain died of his wounds a few days after this had happened. And the assistant naval attaché, whom we met up in Nanking, British naval attaché, was a very bitter, passed over at 2.5, sending out his last days in an obscure position as assistant naval attaché in a rather obscure Chinese town. Suddenly rose to fame because it was decided that the first lieutenant was not experienced enough to take over as a captain. And so this gentleman was ordered to go down and by whatever means possible get overland and join the Amethyst and then take command. And he went partly by train, partly on foot, and partly by sampan. And he eventually, in the dead of night, arrived. He bribed the sampan to paddle him out to the Amethyst, where he arrived on board and took command. Now, my memory serves me correctly, the Amethyst sat where she was for somewhere between 2 and 3 months.
Still occupied by the crew.
Still occupied by the crew. Separated from the shore, but not too far from the shore. Using minimum fuel just to keep their generators going, but not to raise steam or anything. And waited for the time when the tides would be high and the moon would be obscured and it would be a dark night and so on. And such a night arrived, and she raised steam in the dead of night, blacked out, got herself off the mud bank she was on, and then with great skill navigated her way down the mouth of the Yangtze and out of the river at night, with little or no navigational aids and all the boys being out and so on. It was a real feat of seamanship, for which this 2.5 was immediately promoted to commander. The Amethyst was repaired and went back to the UK, and of course they were paraded through the streets of London and given a hero's welcome. So once more the British turned a rather tragic defeat into a sort of semi-magnificent victory. The only interesting thing about the Amethyst experience was that we found ourselves, because of all these battered up British ships and the fact that one was in dry dock down in Singapore, we were the only British type operational destroyer left in the Far East. And I should add that HMS London, the cruiser, also went up the river to rescue the Amethyst, found her 8-inch guns could not depress sufficiently to hit the shore bank, took a lot of hits on the bridge. The navigator had the back of his head blown off, for instance, and subsequently died of his wounds, which was probably saving grace, because he was, there would have been no life left in him, basically. The captain had his left buttock shot off, and HMS London took quite a lot of damage before she too backed off from these anti-tank guns, went back down the river. The American contribution to this was to not to in any way go up the Yangtze, although she had ships, but they did place a hospital ship available to the Royal Navy to take off the wounded from HMS London when London came back down the Yangtze, having failed to rescue the Amethyst.
Was there any indication to you at the time as to why the guns had opened up on the Amethyst?
Largely because the Nationalists were defecting by battalions and regiments to the Communists. And they just got itchy trigger fingers, and some local commander opened up. And then once, of course, that happens, they're committed. But I'm certain in my own mind it was the local initiative, which, of course, immediately got out of hand.
There was speculation at the time, even among British people in the Far East, so I've read that possibly the British had fired first, but can't think of any
reason why. No. There would be absolutely no reason for them to do that. Absolutely none. So that was the Amethyst incident, and we subsequently went up to Alacrity Anchorage with a now gathering British fleet, which the British gathered together as quickly as possible, which is some islands to the south of the mouth of the Yangtze. And we stayed in Alacrity Anchorage with this gathering fleet for about 2 weeks, and then were ordered home to Esquimalt. On the way back, I can remember the men speculating to some considerable degree as to what was going to happen when we got back. Of course, we had to say, by this time, the atmosphere in the ship was quite good and fairly relaxed. It was not an unpleasant atmosphere at all. The men were nervous as to what was going to happen, but that was all. We seemed to have got over our sort of bad period and our problems. And on the whole, the ship, well, of course, we were going home after a 3-4 month trip, so that's always helpful. And we were going home as fast as we could, again, island hopping from American base to American base. And we arrived home in Esquimalt, looking very clean and very tiddly, having had good weather, of course, to paint the ships on. With black guns, which was a feature of the 8th Destroyer Flotilla, which the admiral, the local admiral, immediately ordered painted gray to conform back to RCN's colors. I can remember that. We had to do it almost immediately on return. And then after a weekend in the harbor, everybody went off on a 48 sort of thing. The Menge Commission arrived, headed by the then Captain Menge, Rollo Menge, with two other members, Louis Audet, who was a French-Canadian Montreal lawyer with a considerable amount of RCMBR, wartime experience, and Leonard Brockington, a distinguished elderly Canadian. And this group, I can remember Captain Menge addressing the ship's company and saying that how very sorry they were to delay their well-earned leave and so on. And the purpose of this commission was not to in any way address blame or punishment, but to find out what was wrong with the RCN. And the men's attitude just changed right overnight as soon as they heard that, and they became very difficult to handle once more. And I always thought at the time that that particular comment, while it was designed to get the men to open up, and I'm sure it succeeded in that purpose, was particularly unfortunate and inopportune, and it made our job very difficult. Another little personal thing that I can recount from the Menge report, which is subsequently published, we as junior officers felt rather hard done by. On the one hand, subalterns like myself were criticized as being much too RN in our outlook, having spent 3 years with the Brits by this time. And of course, we had the attitude and outlook of a young RN officer, even though we felt distinctly Canadian still. In a subsequent chapter, just a few pages later, we were again criticized for not being as well trained as our RN and USN counterpart. So we thought we got it
coming and going
in that particular report. So after the commission, Crescent picked up and went on our way, and we did a lot of cruising up and down the coast. By this time, I was a navigator and gunnery officer once more, and I remember we cruised up to Alaska, and we went around the Queen Charlottes, and we went down to Mexico, and generally had a fairly pleasant remaining part of the year, and we paid off Crescent in the end of 1949 and took most of Crescent's crew and commissioned HMCS Sioux, which had been refitted and modernized, at least in her interior, as the RCN's first bunk ship and first all-electric galley. And we converted from an oil-fired galley and the old messing system to a system both for the officers, well, not for the officers, but for the chiefs and POs and the men, and an all-bunk ship. And she was the first. And so she was a very comfortable ship. She had basically her old 4.7 armament and her old almost pre-World War II control system. And I was still the gunnery officer, but I gave up being the navigator, and a fellow named Chesty Norton came along and became the navigator. And it wasn't, and we had not been in commission for all that long, and we'd had one trip under our belts, I think, before, of course, the Korean War broke. And within 3 days, and again a full wartime compliment, sailed for the Korean War in early July. This time it's Cayuga, Athabasca, and Sioux, and went off for the first 10 months of the Korean War, arriving in Sasebo in the latter part of July. Sasebo, Japan, being the main operating base for the then forming United Nations force. There's something I forgot to mention, which just came to mind with reference to the Crescent's departure for Nanking in the previous year, which I think is important. The commander of Ontario, Ontario, had been instructed on a Saturday morning, and we were due to sail on the Monday, to provide 20 seamen for us to bring us up to our wartime strength. And of course, not having been told the purpose of our trip and knowing nothing about where we were headed for or anything, the master at arms went through the ship and produced every skate that they had, and these 20 beauties came marching down the jetty and joined Crescent, and that was part of our problem.
Were they among the men who locked themselves in?
Oh yes, very much so. Very much so. In fact, some of them were the ringleaders of that particular mutiny. And it was unfortunate that people didn't make the commander aware of the fact of why he was sending these 20 people, but it was so hush-hush at the time that very few people were being let in on. But we got 20 of Ontario's best skates.
Did you send them back when you got back around?
No, we brought them all the way back to Esquimalt Harbor and subsequently got rid of them. Four or five, by the way, were eased out of the Navy fairly quickly and fairly quietly, as being fairly professional agitators.
Now, the Sioux was commissioned in early 1950?
Yes, in the in January 1950, as I recall, and proceeded on workups and some local cruises during the spring, early spring. And in July of 1950, of course, the Korean War began, and then North Koreans invading South Korea, and the United Nations actions was initiated. Within 7 days of that decision having been taken, three Canadian destroyers from the West Coast, Cayuga, Athabasca, and Sioux, under the command of Captain Jeffrey Brock, were dispatched to the Far East to a port in southern Japan called Sasebo. And we arrived there in the latter part of July with a full war complement and a full load of ammunition and stores. All of this having been accomplished in something under 3 days. The trip across the Pacific, as I remember, it took us about 21 days, island hopping to pick up fuel as we went along through the American system, Hawaii, Midway, Guam, Wake Island, I believe, and finally Japan. By the time we had arrived in Sasebo in the latter part of July, the United Nations forces, which were primarily American and South Korean at that time, if not exclusively, held only what was called the Pusan perimeter, which was a perimeter of some 40 miles of distance and depth. And the North Koreans had occupied all of the Korean peninsula except that one little foothold. One of our first tasks was to convoy or escort an American transport filled with troops from Japan, who had been doing occupation duties, looking at them lining the rails as we joined the ship. It was obvious to us that these were very young and very inexperienced troops indeed, and we felt that they were in for a very difficult time, which indeed they were. The U.S. merchant captain in command of this transport was extremely reluctant to accept instructions and to be escorted by a ship other than the USN. However, after a certain amount of pressure, he was eventually persuaded to fall in the stern of us and follow us on the way to Busan.
You were the only escort ship?
We were the only escort ship. We returned to Sasebo after that one duty and awaited to be assigned our next patrol, which was to be on the west coast of Korea. By this time, the United Nations forces had been gathering for some time, and there were British ships, British Commonwealth ships, Australian, Canadian, one New Zealander, and there were one or two ships of other nations. There was a Dutch destroyer, for example, which was a sister ship to HMCS Sioux, being a British-built destroyer, called the Evertsen. The division of forces, of naval forces, the United States Navy kept to the East Coast and allocated primary responsibility to the West Coast to the Flag Officer Second in Command, Far Eastern Station, who was a Royal Navy Rear Admiral. And so we found ourselves operating primarily under British naval command once more. The patrols that we went on the West Coast were very lengthy indeed. The longest that I remember between the period of August to December was 45 days long. This meant continuous steaming without a break for 45 days. We fueled about every 3 days during the week, and we received stores from USN sources, from USN supply ships, about once per week. Fortunately, we did not require re-ammunitioning, although we, by this time, were doing some bombardments of West Coast ports occupied by the communist forces in the southern half of Korea. In late August of that year, the Incheon landings took place, and we were a part of that activity, escorting a United States Navy tanker up the river to Incheon. And as the history books will show, Incheon was taken practically without any struggle whatever, and was captured within 24 hours after some fairly token resistance was encountered. This was the turning point in the war, and the Americans were able to turn south and quickly, at the same time breaking out of the Pusan perimeter, and quickly overcome virtually all of the enemy forces, which by this time were considerably overextended all the way down to the southern tip of Korea. This mopping up process, as I remember it, lasted only about a month, and all of South Korea was back in United Nations or Allied hands. The United Nations forces then turned northward and proceeded up towards the Yellow River under General MacArthur's direction. This altered the areas of our patrols, and we began patrolling north of the 38th parallel, right up to the Yellow River, in what was formerly North Korean waters. Our activities included the spotting and destroying of floating mines, which the North Koreans released from the Yellow River area and which floated southward in the prevailing currents, and which were a considerable menace to our shipping, particularly at night. Daylight, of course, was somewhat easier because we were able to spot them in the water, and by this time our lookouts were getting pretty good at spotting these floating mines. As I remember it, between the period of September to December, we destroyed, by Beaufort's gunfire, 14 floating mines, which we discovered in the vicinity of the ship from time to time. Close to Christmas, the Chinese forces invaded across the Yellow River, and the rout once more of the United Nations forces began. By this time, we were north of the 38th parallel, anchored in a river just off a port called Chinanpo. And we were ordered up the river with two Australian destroyers to evacuate civilians and some rear echelon military personnel and then destroy the port with gunfire. As we proceeded up this river at night, we had to go through a minefield, in fact several minefields, which the extent of which was not too clearly known. The lead destroyer was an Australian, and she promptly ran aground in the soft, sandy river, receiving no damage and being able to back off. Sue did the same thing some few minutes later, and in backing off, got a mine and a mine wire around our screw. We had to proceed back down the river to an anchorage so that we could wait for the tide to slack, lower a diver over the side, and cut the wire that was wrapped around our screw, and to which we believed was attached a mine, fortunately not apparently functioning. This took us several hours because the tide was so strong that the divers would be strung right out in the water and could not maintain any kind of a grip on the screw in order to do the work. By this time, the force consisting of Cayuga and Athabasca and two Australian destroyers had completed the evacuation, blown up the port, and destroyed the oil field facilities there, proceeding back down the river, by which time we rejoined them and withdrew. The next 3 months saw again lengthy patrol activities for us, all on the West Coast. By this time, we had been linking up with a South Korean former Japanese gunboat, which was of shallow draft and could work close inshore. And from time to time, we lent small arms, automatic submachine guns, etc., plus several thousand rounds of ammunition to this commander in the South Korean Navy, in the ROK Navy, who then proceeded ashore at night into the towns and villages to shoot up the town in typical Western style. He would always return the submachine guns, the Sten guns, and the Lanchesters that we gave him the next morning, much to my relief as the ship's gunnery officer, but there was never any ammunition returned. In March of 1951, Sue was ordered home to begin the first rotation and was the first ship back 9 months after the commencement of the Korean War. When we arrived back in the Esquimalt Harbor, to our astonishment, some 50,000 people were down there trying to get into the dockyard and to welcome the ship back. I don't think the dockyard before or since has ever seen such a concentration of people. There were 10,000 people attempting to stand on the jetty as we got alongside. It was a very significant welcome, and of course there was intense curiosity about the war and what we had seen and what we had encountered.
I should think there was a fair amount of press coverage at home of your
There was indeed.
Ships, yeah.
There was indeed. There was pages and pages and pages of it. I was directed by the captain to go over to Vancouver and accept some speaking engagements on his behalf, which he was not prepared to undertake, because the ship was turning around and was going to be leaving in 4 or 5 weeks' time with some relief and replacements. I was appointed away from the ship and sent to HMC Escotian, a reserve division in Halifax, where I became the staff officer for a few months while awaiting appointment to my long gunnery course in the UK, which took place in September of that year. And I then went to HMS Excellence and took my long gunnery course for a 15-month period.
Did you ever meet any serious opposition in Korea from either shore batteries or aircraft?
We never came under any fire. Subsequently, one of our ships did, under Captain Landemore's command, and she received some casualties, but she, to the best of my memory, was the only Canadian destroyer hit during that war. The only real opposition that we ever encountered was in the type of floating mines that we encountered on a regular, fairly frequent basis.
And you never saw much sign of either the North Korean or the Chinese Air Force at any point?
Oh. During the Incheon landings, interestingly enough, there was a rather ancient and elderly British cruiser by the name of HMS Jamaica was part of that task force, landing force. There were also two large new city-class 8-inch American cruisers bristling with modern guns and armaments and so on. Two Yak aircraft, which are fast propeller-driven aircraft, similar in type to performance, I would think, to the Sea Furies that we carried in our carriers, suddenly flew over the Incheon area, over the harbor. HMS Jamaica, with her ancient World War II two-pounder pom-pom guns, opened fire, and one of the Yaks fell into the sea, into the harbor. There was a sort of astonished silence over the entire area, and not an American gun had been fired. General MacArthur witnessed this to the misfortune of the captain of the USN cruiser, who was sent home to the States the next day.
Considered it a national insult that
yes.
The Americans hadn't shot it down.
Yeah.
So you never went back to Korea after that? That was
no, that was by this time I was over in the UK doing my long course, and I got back to Canada in 1953, by which time the fighting was over, but not the waiting, and the armistice, as you know, dragged on for some time. And we kept one ship out there for a lengthy period of time, who is first of all HMCS Sioux and then HMCS Crusader was out there for extended periods. But the war by that time was over.
All right, if in the time we have left, then I wonder if you could just briefly sum up what your career has been since then.
Well, after that, I went to Venture. I was the parade training officer in the barracks in 53 and 54, and I went to Venture, HMCS Venture, in 54 as a term lieutenant for a 2-year officer training stint, after which I became the squadron gunnery officer of the 2nd Escort Squadron on the West Coast with Captain Sterling. In 1958, I went to Halifax and became the command gunnery officer under Rear Admiral Hugh Francis Pullen, and remained in that position for 3 years and 2 months, during which I suffered through the introduction of the 3-inch 70 gun into our system and into our 257 class destroyers, which was a very painful introduction because it was an extremely complex gun and gave us a lot of difficulty to begin with. It was known as the civil servant. It wouldn't work and you couldn't fire it. In 1962, I became the executive officer of HMCS Restigouche and proceeded on a pierhead jump of 48 hours notice to go to Gibraltar with the 5th Escort Squadron and take part in a British naval exercise called Dawn Breeze. I left the Restigouche in 64 and went to the Canadian, the RCF Staff College in Toronto as a student for 1 year, after which I was when I graduated, I was promoted to commander and sent to Ottawa to work under the Director of Common Military Training as the Assistant Director of Common Military Training, which included recruit training and rank training for the then three services. In 1967, I went and took command of HMCS Marguerite, a DDH helicopter carrying destroyer, and spent a year and a half there, doing a lot of sea time because the other two ships in the small cot squadron we were then operating were being converted and readied to receive their helicopters. The result is that I stayed at sea most of the time during this period. In 1968, I went back to the Staff College as the Deputy Director, as a member of the directing staff and then as the Deputy Director in charge of curriculum development, and left there in 1972, becoming the executive officer of HMCS Provider back on the West Coast. I stayed in Provider until 1974, when I assumed my final appointment as Queen's Harbour Master of Esquimalt Harbour, in charge of all the docks and facilities, tugs, pilots, and auxiliary vessels, of which there were 33, manned by 250 civilian crew scattered around the 33 vessels. And I retired from the service in 1975, having served 32 and a half years, counting the Royal Roads period.
Just one last question, really, as someone who served for a long time on both sides of the unification, how did you react to that when it came through?
I reacted to it like most naval officers of my age. I found it very difficult to adjust to it and to accept its principles, observing that they were politically motivated and not militarily motivated. The way it was done and the timing of it and the method and the scheduling was clearly motivated exclusively by political considerations. And I think this is the principal objection that most of us felt about it at the time. The then Minister of National Defense, Mr. Hellier, exhibited a high degree of unscrupulousness and lack of integrity in the way he tackled this problem. And as the opposition grew, his clear lack of integrity became more and more evident.
Did you find that impaired the efficiency of the service?
Certainly, it did. What exacerbated the situation even further was that almost immediately after the trauma of the unification process, about 2 years later, the services then went through a period of restraint and frozen budgets, which further made it difficult for us. And in fact, in terms of spending, we have never really recovered from that period.
Okay, thank you very much, Commander.